And to make sure, for example, the table in front of you is also empty.
Yeah.
But in our diluted state, or my diluted state anyway, the table does have shape.
Right.
So why is it that the mind doesn't and the table does?
Well, I mean, when we look at our mind, normally it looks like it has color and content, right? Because it has thoughts and emotions. And the thoughts and emotions are the relative side of the mind, just as the solidity of the table and the shape of the table is the reality of the table. But when you look into the actual ultimate nature of the mind, you cannot grasp it. And it is, it's as we say, it's like space, right? And so it's empty, even though there is the luminous clarity side of it, which is the thoughts and feelings, right? And likewise with the table, I mean, modern physics will tell you that this is really all space. But it looks very solid to us, and if I hit it with you, you'd feel it. And so this is what is so interesting. Great teachers who have really directly experienced the empty nature of physical phenomena can leave handprints or push the, I mean, like, there's a story of Gyawako Tsangpa, a great Drukpa Kagyu yogi of the 12th, 13th century. And he had this little cave that he was living in with his attendant, and it was a very small cave. And so he thought, well, you know, it really is very small. So he started pushing it to make it bigger. And then his attendant realized he had that ability, so he said, oh great, look, over there we need it a bit bigger over here, and then if you could push up there. And Gotsang said, no, let's not overdo this. You know, this gets to be just desire and greed and attachment. It was a little bit big, small, we pushed it enough, but leave it at that. But the reason they can do that, and you see, I mean, this is not just stories. Well, I lived in Lahul. And Gyawako Tsangpa lived for many years in Lahul, although he was Tibetan. And there are the caves and rocks, even now, covered with handprints and footprints of Gotsangpa. But the reason they can do that is because even though they see the physicality of it, they also see its essential empty nature. So therefore, there's no obstacle. And Dingo Kensi Rinpoche, I remember one time he said to us that when he was 8 years old and he started practicing, then everything became transparent. And he could see outside of walls what was going on outside, and nothing had any boundaries anymore. So, I mean, you know, this is an actual fact. And we are just trapped in our relative mind into thinking this, because we perceive it this way ourselves, this is how it actually is. And likewise with the mind.
My other question was regarding dreams.
Yeah.
Rinpoche last night said that dreams, dreams and this reality are similar, and that if we recognize the illusory nature of both, but it seems like dreams, realizing the illusory nature of dreams is more simple or easier for me, at least, than...
Yeah, of course, everybody.
But why is that that they're the same?
Because we are steeped in the deep sleep of ignorance since beginningless time. That's why we are in samsara. If you remember, the word Buddha means to wake up, right? We are all dreaming the dream of samsara. And what we are trying to do is wake up, you know? I mean, so the closest analogy to that is our nightly dreaming. While we're in a dream, it's all very real. If we have a pleasant dream, then, you know, we wake up feeling so nice, and in the dream we're so happy. If it's a nightmare, our hearts thud, right? If it's, and we wake up feeling like we've been in a trauma, even it's a dream. And I mean, our body reacts. If it's a sad dream, we wake up and our pillow is wet with our tears. So for the time we're dreaming, it's totally real. But if in the dream we can recognize this is just a dream, which is what dream yoga is about, then, oh, it's just a dream. Let's change it. All right, I'm not going to be in this horrible, frightening situation. I will transform this monster into Chenrezig. And it will change into Chenrezig. Okay, I'm not going to stay in this dream. I'm going to go to a pure land. We can go to a pure land. Right? We can transform and play with the dream because we know it's a dream. And when we wake up, however deep the dream has been, and however real it might have seemed, the moment we wake up, we recognize that was just a dream. And then if we fall asleep again, we recognize this is just a dream, it doesn't affect us. This is a beautiful analogy of the spiritual path. Even if, because we are so deeply asleep, dreaming our dream of ignorance, it all seems so real. So real. We are affected by everything which happens to us, good and bad, and we believe in it so intensely. If we could just, even for a moment, wake up, realize the nature of the mind, really experience and realize the essential, illusory, empty nature, then even though things happen, we are not affected in that way. And even though we then go back into our dream of ignorance, we know, oh, this is really just a dream. This isn't really how things really are. There is something beyond all this. I did experience that. That's why this essential breaking through into the nature of the mind, a really decisive experience in the nature of the mind, transforms. Because even though we go back to sleeping again, still we know this time it's just a dream, and there is such a thing as awakening. So it's very important, because we've been asleep so long and we're sleeping so deeply. And this is also why Mingyur Rinpoche said, when you get a really very direct experience, even for a short time, naturally deep compassion arises, because you see that your situation is shared by everybody. You look into people's eyes and you see that they are really asleep. And so they suffer so much. Because, to change the analogy, they are so much involved in their soap opera. And they can't see it's just a drama. And so they suffer tremendously. And you know, you see that it's not necessary, because it's all manufactured through our mind. If only we could just get our mind together. How tragic. We destroy ourselves, we destroy others, we destroy our planet, because we don't know our minds. And our mad monkey minds are running everything. I mean, they're voted up as presidents.
How do you think that is? I've always wondered that.
Because we are so steeped in ignorance. And we are so in control of the five poisons, and that we can't imagine anything beyond that. We just don't know. Most people, we are very, 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 very fortunate that we have the opportunity to meet with people who know. And so this gives us an inkling that if they know, maybe we can also know. You know, they're human beings, we're human beings. And then they're trying to help us to understand how to become like they are. But, 99% of the world never meets with even the idea that there's anything outside of samsara. Even a possibility. If you realize something, then you're told you're crazy, you're psychotic. I get a lot of letters from people who tell me when they were young, they had genuine experience of the essential illusory nature of the world, and that there was some other level of awareness, of consciousness behind the coming and going of the thoughts. But when they tried to express this to their parents or their priests or their rabbis or whoever, they were told, you mustn't think like that. That way lies craziness. And so they had this tremendous inner conflict of having understood something which they knew in the depths of their being was the truth, and everybody they respected telling them it was a lie. So how fortunate that we are in an environment where the truth is recognized as the truth and lies are recognized as lies. Because most of the world doesn't even know that much. They don't even think. They think the brain is it. There's nothing beyond the brain. I mean, how sad. No wonder everyone's so depressed with all their Mercedes and their fancy watches and their, you know.
But I think people now, and I want to hear what you think about this, more and more people seem to have an inkling, even if they can't verbalize it, and even if it's just some sense, you know. Mm-hmm. I see that more and more. I had, my mom was in the hospital in this intensive care unit, and there was the doctor treating her. She was unconscious, you know, she's in a breathing machine. And I said, oh, she looks like she's in pain, maybe you can give her a little more, whatever. And he said, oh no, you know, she can't possibly be conscious at this point. And I said, well, I don't think really we can begin to know about consciousness. And he just looked at me in the eye and he said, I think you're right. And this was just a very...
Yeah.
I find more and more, there's like a... Do you find that?
Yeah, and there are more and more articles appearing in very mainstream magazines and newspapers which are dealing with this. But, I mean, so there is some awareness there, but still most people don't have a clue of where they're going. And there's so many kind of spurious ideas along with it that people get very confused. I mean, we should be deeply grateful to have happened on a path which is genuinely authentic and has a very clear direction of what you should do and where you should go. Because, I mean, still in this day and age with all our technology and information, there's a lot of rubbish out there posing as truth.
Talking about if we can rest in the nature of mind, then we can bypass karma.
At that moment.
Yeah. And purify karma. How does an animal or someone who has absolutely no contact with the Dharma, how do things purify?
They don't. This is why being in a lower realm is a lower realm. The reason why when you're in the nature of the mind you're not making karma is because there's no ego. And it's the ego which creates the karma. Somebody, one Burmese monk once described it by saying, if you think of the individual karmas, karma means any actions of body, speech and mind which are intentional. So if you think of the karmas like all these beads, right? Then if you pull one bead, all the other beads come along, right? And why do all the other beads come along? It's because they're held together by the string. And the string is the idea that I did this. And as long as we think that there is someone doing an action, which is our sense of ego, then that pulls along all the other karmas, and we are always trapped within the karmas. So therefore, a decisive realization that there is nothing, there is no actor behind the action, cuts the string. And after that, even though you might pull one bead, the other beads stay behind. So therefore, during a time of direct experience of the nature of the mind, at that time there is no actor. There is just spontaneous manifestation. So someone who is always in a state of pure awareness spontaneously acts. They're not, cogitating about it. They spontaneously act in a way which is totally appropriate to that moment. But whatever they say and think and do just naturally arises.
Mm-hmm.
without any sense of an agent behind it. And in that state of openness, there's no karma. But as long as there is a feeling of I'm doing this, or I'm saying this, or any thoughts are surrounding me, then there is karma. And so animals are in one way very spontaneous, because they tend to do whatever their nature tells them to do. But nonetheless, they are very concerned with themselves. And they cannot get beyond that. That's why being trapped in an animal realm is extremely difficult, because it's difficult to get beyond that and go back up again. I mean, they still have Buddha nature. Everybody has Buddha nature. Mosquitoes have Buddha nature. But to actually be in a level where you can actually directly realize and experience that, even among human beings, is rare. And for an animal, it's very difficult, because an animal will naturally be following its instincts, and its instincts are creating a karma to keep getting reborn as an animal. I mean, I think sometimes pets, you know, people get very close to their pets, and some pets, not all, but some you feel are really striving to reach up and communicate. They really are wanting something. And I think those ones might be on the way up. But other pets just are happy being dogs or cats, and they, you know, you can see that that's where they're going to keep getting reborn. Hmm.
For the one from karma, I once heard a Rinpoche from the moment say that, for example, somebody could have a cancer that is definitely karmically produced, and that you can actually do mantras, etc., like that, but it's not going to really make much difference to it. But you can get others that are not from karma. If everything's a cause and effect, how can that possibly be possible?
Well, you know, according to the Buddha in the Pali Canon, I don't know if the Tibetans follow it, the Savastivada say this, but in the Pali Canon, it very clearly says, the Buddha said, that there are four causes for things to happen. And one is karma. But there are other things, like there could be a natural disaster, and somehow you're caught up in it. And then there's the seasons. I mean, the fact that it's raining isn't necessarily your karma. It's just that it's raining, you know, so hot and cold and raining and dry doesn't necessarily have to. I mean, in general, everything which happens is due to the collected karma of the beings in this universe, not just human beings, but the animals and spirits and everything. We create the universe from our karma. But on an individual level, you might be caught up in the group karma, so to speak. And so there's the seasons, natural disasters, karma, and something else I don't remember. But anyway, in the Pali Canon, it's not everything is karma, individual karma. It can just be that you're caught up in external happenings, and there you are. So also with something like cancer, I mean, it's due to our karmas that we, because, you know, you might all be, some people smoke and smoke and smoke and smoke and smoke and they never get lung cancer. Somebody else just comes in the room and they're not smokers at all and they end up with lung cancer because they're smelling the smoke. So obviously some people have the karma to get it and some people don't. And also likewise with the cure, some people have the possibility that they could be cured, and some people don't have the possibility. So that even if they are cured, say, all right, they have some miracle medicine and they cure them of the cancer, they walk out the hospital and they get run down by a bus. Because your life is cut off, you've got to go. And if you don't go one way, you go another. But then others who could have a life extension, that would help them and they could carry on. So and then karma is extraordinarily difficult, you know. I mean, Ananda, you know, the Buddha's attendant, he one time said to the Buddha, well, you know, I realize that karma is pretty complicated, but I think I got it. And the Buddha said, no, don't say that. You haven't got it. He said, only a fully enlightened Buddha can understand karma. And no one else can understand it. And the best you can do is to try to keep to the basic principles and rules and try to make what we hope is good karma and avoid bad karma. That's the best you can do. Beyond that, because it's like a huge tapestry. And we see this tiny little bit, you know? And mostly we see it from the behind with all the knots and the loose ends. How can we see the complete picture? You have to get in front and pull yourself back. Then you see the whole picture. And then you also understand why those black threads are as important as the bright red and yellow and green threads. They all make the picture. And we only want the bright ones. We don't want the dark ones. But maybe the dark ones are the ones which are going to complete this whole pattern. So, I mean, when the Buddha, you remember when the Buddha got enlightened? In the first watch of the night, he went back through all his past lives. And then in the second watch of the night, he saw the coming and going of all the beings in the universe. And then in the third watch of the night, he understood interdependent origination. So what he's saying is that what made him a Buddha, a Samyaksambuddha, was that his mind completely opened and to its fullest potential, of which we use, as everybody knows, I mean, even brain specialists say we use such a minute percentage of our mind. His mind opened up to its hugest potential and he experienced everything which was happening in the universe, backwards, forwards, and future. So then he could directly understand how karma works, because he could see the whole canvas, the whole tapestry. But we see such a small, small part. And this is why we say, well, why does this happen to me? If we could see the whole picture, it would be obvious why it's happening. And maybe why it should happen. We always want good things to happen, then we think, oh, this is nice karma. And if something difficult happens, we think it's bad karma, but maybe the bad karma is really the most useful karma. You know, it's our judgmental mind which categorizes this is the bad part and this is the good part. How do we know? In Buddhism, you know that to be born in the heavens is regarded as spiritually a dead end. And the reason why it's a dead end is because, you know, you have such a great time, you're partying every night. Who cares about sitting and looking at the nature of the mind? And so you use up enormous amounts of good karma, and then down you come. Feeling traumatized because, you know, that suddenly you're in a physical form again after mere millenniums up in rainbow bodies, light bodies, having everything you want instantly gratified. Now suddenly you're back. But all that time that you spent having a great time up in the heavenly realms was a total waste of time. Nothing has been learned from that except attachment. And the reason why this human life, which we all share, is so important is because there are the good sides and the bad sides. If you're in the hell realms, you're so suffering the whole time, it's like you're psychotic. You know, you can't think outside of your own horrendous predicament. You can't open your heart to think of anyone else. But the human realm, we have this mixture of good things and difficult things, and this is where we learn. So we shouldn't always, I mean, the Buddha said samsara is dukkha. Why are we always surprised when things go wrong? Samsara is dukkha, so okay, it's dukkha. We can deal with that. This is how we get our muscles. You know, I mean, I have to say, if you want to develop physical muscle, as if I'm picking up this up and down, it's not going to do anything, you know? If I want to get muscles, I have to pick up heavy weights. Then you get muscles. And in spiritual life, it's the same. If you're always looking for pleasure and comfort and, you know, everything going exactly the way we want it to go, what do we learn? But you're all in India, so you know that. But, you know, most of us, when we look back on our lives, we see it was during the difficult times that we really developed and we learned. And it's like going on vacation, you know, well, it's very nice, but if your whole life was vacation, then what, you know? So vacations are nice. When things go right, that's very nice, but when things go wrong, that's when we really, you know, bring up our inner resources, learn how to deal skillfully with situations, and inwardly grow. So we shouldn't really judge karma or karmic results, of course, the vipaka, not the karma. Karma is the actual actions. The vipaka as being good or bad. It's what is happening at this moment. And the question is, how do I respond to this, what is happening, in a skillful way to create more and more development? That's how we cultivate. So in this way, karma, whatever karma comes to us, whatever karma vipaka comes to us, is useful, is helpful. It's not a matter of good karma, bad karma. It's a matter of how can we skillfully respond and use it on the path, as the path.
I was wondering, we all have a Buddha nature, essentially?
I hope so.
I was wondering, basically, do you think it's possible that we set ourselves up for a future, like subconsciously, we know that we need to suffer this particular thing, so we set ourselves up, perhaps with our Buddha nature or something.
Well, Buddha nature doesn't set anything up.
You know, well, you said that bad karma can oftentimes be an opportunity to learn.
If we use it.
Right. So do you think...
It's up to us.
So, okay, do you think subconsciously we know that we need to suffer this particular thing, and that we do things that will ultimately, that will bring about that suffering?
I mean, you know, who knows? Psychologically, people do some very strange things, and it's true that they sometimes attract things to them again and again. Might not be that they're learning from them. I mean, it's like women who tend to end up endlessly having abusive husbands. You know, when do they ever learn? So it could be that we also, because we're so in total delusion, we act to unconsciously draw to us things which are maybe not to our own benefit at all because of our act of delusion. The point is that whatever happens to us, we always have a choice. Either we can respond skillfully or unskillfully. And if we respond skillfully, then whatever the situation, we can transform it and use it for our cultivation. And as they say, we take all circumstances on the path, right? But normally what happens is that if something is difficult, then we respond unskillfully. We get depressed, we get angry, we get upset, we get self-pitying. We have all these negative emotions which come up, which don't solve the situation, which make the situation even worse, and take us away from our genuine ability to cultivate. But nobody's making us react unskillfully. It's us ourselves who are doing this. And this is why it's very, very important to really take that idea of taking everything, using everything on the path. And not discriminating that, oh yes, when I find the perfect place, which is completely silent, and which, you know, I'm going to be given nice food 3 times a day, and, you know, it doesn't cost anything because the people are philanthropists, then I will practice. You know, this idea that when the circumstances are perfect, then I will really start to practice. Because if we think like that, then we will be into our next rebirth and still wondering what hit us. The thing is that whatever happens to us, this is our practice at that time. Because if we think like that, then we have no hope and fear. Do you understand? I mean, normally we are thinking so much, we want everything to go right, we hope things won't go wrong. And so always there is that hope and fear in our hearts, you know? But if we are open to welcoming whatever happens and knowing that whatever happens, we can use it as the path to develop qualities which we wouldn't be able to develop if we didn't have challenges, then there's no hope and fear. Whatever happens, fine, we'll deal with it. We can learn from everything. So then that opens up the mind tremendously. And one rests in the moment without any anxiety for what will manifest itself next.
Yeah.
I mean, we create so many problems for ourselves. Goodness me. As if there weren't enough. You can see it all the time in oneself, in others, how we create so many problems. Even if there isn't a problem, what to speak of when there is. Isn't it interesting? I mean, I'm just asking you, but I mean, you know, on one level we are so intelligent, so intelligent. On the other level we're so stupid. Sometimes one is really sorry that the planet is run by these two-legged beings, you know? You really mess things up quite a bit.
Some people in Hinduism, they feel that we are all working out our prarabdha, that is our karmas,
mm-hmm.
which were allotted for this lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
We have got just, I mean, big store
mm-hmm.
of all bad karmas also, collected over thousands and thousands of births. And this life, when the person takes his birth, then some out of those storehouse,
mm-hmm.
Some are chosen to be worked out in this life,
mm-hmm.
so that he is on the path.
Mm-hmm.
Behind intention is that this man must rise higher and higher.
Mm-hmm.
So when we work here, as you very kindly said, that we should use everything, our response should be to react to the karma very positively, and that it has come to our improvement.
Mm. Well, we can use it to improve ourselves. It the karma itself is totally neutral, it could care less.
Exactly.
But we ourselves can make a use of it.
Uh-huh. So, I mean, this is a training center?
Well, I don't think it hurts to think of it as a training center.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, as I say, the karma itself has no intention. Right? The karma just is, we planted the seeds, we're watering them, the plant comes up. But it's not the intention of the seed per se to come up, it's just the nature of the seed to come up. And so that we are the result, as we sit here now, we are the result of all the collections of actions, of body, speech, and mind, intentional actions of body, speech, and mind, since incalculable time. And so therefore, at any given time, you don't know what's going to come up. Because in the past, we have all of us done the most incredibly wonderful things. We have also done the most incredibly awful things. We have all been male, we have all been female, we have all been animals, we've been in the hell realms and the heavenly realms. And it's like, you know, snakes and ladders, you're up, then you're down. And so in this lifetime, which karmas are going to come up, who knows? Because we've all done wonderful things, we've all done awful things. And we don't know which karmas are going to come up, which seeds are going to sprout in this lifetime. And so the most wonderfully good, kind, lovely beings get horrible things happening to them. The most obnoxious people have a fantastic time. Because we are not receiving usually the karmic results of the karmas which we have planted in this lifetime. Sometimes there are immediate ones, but mostly they are long growing. So we are receiving the results of past karmas. And we don't know what those past karmas are, because we've all done good things, bad things. We don't know what's going to come up. So we're not in control of that. And the karmas are not in control of that. It's very arbitrary according to their own causes and conditions. We cannot choose the causes and conditions. Those causes and conditions, like the rain falling and the sun shining, it's out of our control. What we have got in our control is once that vipaka, once that result has manifested in whatever has happened to us in the moment, how we respond. Because how we respond to that is creating our future karma. So therefore, if we respond negatively, we're creating more trouble for ourselves in the future. If we respond positively, then we are creating auspicious circumstances for the future. And if we respond with wisdom, then we are completely clearing that karma in that moment. So therefore, the only thing we have any control over is our responses. Other than that, you see, and also, it's not all set down like this. You know, one time the Buddha was with one of his disciples, and he was outside a city gate. And there was this old sort of tramp, this old down-and-out guy who had just died. And he was lying there. And the Buddha said, you know, he had been the son of a very noble family. And he really wanted to be a monk. He met me, he really wanted to be a monk. But he was very, very attached to his wife. And so he decided, no, he couldn't be a monk. And he stayed with his wife. Then later on, he got into drinking, he got into gambling, and he lost all his wealth. And he's ended up as this bum outside the city gate. If he had chosen at that time to be a monk, he would have become an arahat. But he chose wrong. And so then all the circumstances for his wrong choice came up. If he'd gone that way, then it would have been a whole different set of choices. So, I mean, the fact is it wasn't decided which way he was going to choose. And always through our life we have choices. And depending on what choice we make, it brings in a whole other set of causes and conditions for karmas to come up. So it's not like it's already all set out and we have to follow the script. The script we are creating moment by moment by moment by our responses, skillful or otherwise, and our choices, skillful or otherwise. Do you see? So that creates, the very choice creates the causes and effects to come into being. It's like you push another button on your computer and a whole different program turns up. So we are much more in charge than it sounds sometimes when you hear about karma. We are creating moment to moment to moment.
Then who is making the choice?
Now that's a good question. On a relative level, usually the ego is making a choice. On an ultimate level, then there are no choices being made because it's all empty. She said, who is making the choices? So on a relative level, the ego in its delusion is making the choices. And that's why we make a lot of bad choices. As we begin to become a little more aware, then we begin to get more skillful choices. When we are genuinely in a state of pure awareness, there is no longer choice. The appropriate response occurs. But there's no longer an ego behind it, driving it, thinking, should I do this, should I do that? it will obvious what should be done next. And everyone else will see that as a wonderfully, spontaneously appropriate response, but the person concerned has not made the choice, it's just been obvious what to do next, what to say next. So when you meet, you're in the presence of great masters, everything which they do. I remember one time somebody saying to me, why is it when Rinpoche, come to Rinpoche, my Lama, that one there, when he just, you know, drinks a cup of tea, it has so much meaning. And all the most meaningful things I do seem so pointless. And it was true. When you're in the presence of a great master, every action that they do has this significance, but you don't really know what it is. But you know that somehow this is Buddha activity. But it's not like directed by the ego, that's why. You feel that it's directed by a much vaster awareness. Even though they're not going reaching. Touching, lifting, you know, like in the mindfulness training. I mean, he just reaches out and picks up his cup, you know. But when he reaches out and picks up his cup, and when I reach out and pick up my cup, this is a whole different world.
Are we not influenced, if we have many past lives we have done, we are on the good way, partly we are blind. And then in this lifetime when we are there, when our choices are being made, at the time our old masters, old influence, good influences, they
sure.
come and work.
Sure.
So then there will be no bad choice.
For who?
A person coming, say, good path, I've fallen long time, good path, and he has come into this lifetime, and then he is making many choices, many are good, and some are bad, and they happen to be bad. But is he not influenced not to make such a...
Well, you know, until we are, you know, fully enlightened Buddhas, that we are still influenced by a certain amount of delusion. And the fact of the matter is that even if you have very, you know, profound, genuine realizations, still there are areas which are, you know, there is some ignorance there. I mean, the obvious thing is this Zen thing of saying that if you take the nature of the mind, it's like a mirror, right? A huge, vast mirror, vast. And it's covered by a thick layer of dust. Right. So when we look at the mirror, when we look at our mind, all we see is the dust. And that's normally our state of being. It's just all we see is dust. But if we took a pin or a needle, and we made a little hole through the dust, then you see that bright bit of light coming, that reflecting brightness from the mirror. And suddenly we realize, oh, you know, we're not the dust. Underneath that, there's something else, right? There's this, and this is why it's very important, that initial breakthrough, because we suddenly realize we're not who we think we are. It's something quite different to this. But the mirror is still covered in dust. So what we need to do is to make that hole bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and clear away the dust, make sure no more dust is falling. When the mirror is completely cleared, not a speck of dust, no more dust falling, we're Buddha. Until then, there are going to be areas which are dusty. And that's why there are levels, even in a bodhisattva, even if you have a very direct realization of emptiness, you still, that only puts you on the first level. I mean, you still have a long way to go, you know, 10, 12, 13, 16 levels, depending on your classification. But anyway, the idea is that when you get a decisive realization of the nature of the mind, that's when you start to meditate. It's not the end, it's the beginning. of the real path. So that's why even great masters can make mistakes until they are completely Buddha. Buddha never made mistakes.
Why this enlightenment has been made so difficult?
Because we are in a very, very, very deep sleep and very, very deep ignorance, and through millennia and eons of time the dust has been falling. And so it's a pretty thick coating of dust. On the one level, as Mingyur Rinpoche said, the nature of the mind is so close that it's like the eyes, it cannot see themselves because they're so too close. And likewise, the nature of the mind, which is our awareness, our consciousness, the knowing behind the coming and going of the thoughts, is always with us. But it's so close that we don't see it because we're always looking over there. And as he said again, it's like space. You know, when we look in this room, I say to you, what's in this room? And you'll say, well, there are people, and there are seats, and there are pictures, and there's statues, and there's a table. But you won't mention, and there was infinite space. You don't see the space. You only see the people and the seats. And this is like our mind. We look at the mind, all we see is our thoughts and our emotions. We don't see the support for the thoughts and the emotions. And it's not that it's not them every moment waiting to be seen. It's that it's very difficult for us to know how to look. Or even to have the idea of looking. Because we're all here now and we're all interested in the same thing, and we've probably all heard about Mahamudra before, it seems like, oh, yeah, the nature of the mind, right. But actually in the world it's very rare to hear anybody talk about the nature of the mind. They don't know about the nature of the mind. They don't know who we really are. And I mean, you know, 99.999% of the world don't know. And this is why we are born again and again and again in ignorance, often in societies which don't help us to know. That's why. But you know, once we realize which way we're supposed to be going and we try to do it, then we discover that actually it's not so difficult, really, because it's what we are. It's who we are. You know, it's not something up in the clouds. It's right here, so close to us. We almost, as I say, we miss it. We keep looking over there when it's right here. So, you know, but to make it so that the difference between just in moments of clarity and, you know, 24 hours clarity. I don't know, any of you have read Blazing Splendor?
Yes.
You will notice in that two or three times people say, I am able to keep awareness the whole time, except during that moment when I just fall asleep for a few seconds, I lose it. So it's, I mean, these were people who lived on this earth, you know, and if you can do that, you can do that. And when you are that level of being constantly in a state of the nature of the mind, then you're liberated. So, I mean, you know, we can do it. The problem is that we expect that, you know, it's going to happen in a weekend course. But we should be very grateful that we have such exemplary teachers to help us and to point out to us the nature of the mind and the practice. And from our side, we have to do it, because they can't do it for you. Even if the Lord Buddha, even if Manjushri himself was sitting here, all they could say is practice. They can't do it for you. But that we know there is a practice and that someone has taught us the practice is an incredible result of infinite amount of good karma from past lives and this life. So we shouldn't waste it, because if we waste it, then it doesn't come again. So be happy.
can you explain to me, what is the difference
between when a vipassana practitioner serving the mind and seeing the nature of the mind. It feels like, it looks like that it is something, because the process is so different. Because with the observing the nature, the observing the mind is like you are observing the incredible activities of the mind. So you are aware of as many things as you possibly can, but like what we've been taught here, to observe the nature, is something quite different. And so the outcome is probably quite different too. It's still so, it's still kind of so complementary and so much similar in a way.
Some of you might have heard of Joseph Goldstein. He has the Insight Meditation Society in America. And he studied for many, many years with Mahasi Sayadaw and Goenka and of course, you know, he and Sharon Salzberg and Jack Kornfield. And then after many, 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 many years, and you know, very exemplary teachers, they went to Ujjain Thukpa and then to Soknyi Rinpoche to learn Dzogchen. So I was very curious. So when I met Jack Korn, Goldstein, I said to Joseph, I said to him, why did you do that? And he said that he had got to a certain point and he felt like there was a ceiling which he couldn't get beyond. And he needed a technique to dissolve that inner ceiling. And Dzogchen had those methods. I asked Soknyi Rinpoche why he thought these Vipassana people had come. And he said that through their techniques they had realized the subtle mind, but they had not realized the very subtle mind. And so therefore they had realized, you know, thoughts and the nature of the thoughts and how thoughts are moving moment to moment to moment and they're like a stream, but they hadn't connected with that inherent knowing principle behind that, the nature of the mind they hadn't seen. They had seen the nature of the conceptual mind, but they hadn't seen that which was behind it. And therefore they couldn't dissolve it back into inherent emptiness again, space, as the Dzogchen say. They couldn't dissolve back into space.
So that.
But when you read someone like Ajahn Chah, for example, the great Thai master, forest master, sometimes it's like reading a Dzogchen text. So I think it also depends on the masters. Because he talks a lot about space and conscious, the knowing principle behind coming and going of the thoughts dissolving that into space and things like that. He uses stuff that sounds actually quite a lot like Dzogchen terminology, which he himself invented.
So that would mean that the Vipassana practitioner who is completely aware of enlightenment but decides to go for liberation because it takes so long, that a accomplished Vipassana practitioner would, in a very quick time, because of the accomplishment he already has achieved, if we choose that particular path.
Which particular path?
So
yeah,
it would be very, very quick.
And this is why many teachers like Soknyi Rinpoche and Trungpa Rinpoche and others advised their students to do several years of Vipassana first, because if their minds are so well trained and so clear and aware, then when they are told to do these Mahamudra or Dzogchen practices, they can actually do them. And the results come very fast. I mean, it's not that there's either or. And I mean, the strict training in learning how to observe the mind is a perfect preparation for Mahamudra or Dzogchen. Because a lot of people, especially in the West, you know, they all want the golden roof, but they're not interested in digging the foundations and building up strong walls. I mean, I know I'm building, you know, endlessly building in our nunnery. And I see this, you know, it takes a month digging foundations and putting in the plumbing and putting making the foundations, and it's not in the least bit exciting or romantic or beautiful. But if you've got really good, strong, firm foundations, building up the walls and putting on the gold roof takes no time compared. And that building is strong and will stay. If your foundations are weak, however fancy the walls and the beautiful frescoes, it's going to be cracking and falling down in no time. But people only want the gold roofs and the frescoed walls. They don't want the foundations. And so that is our big mistake, you know. And the lamas nowadays are very frustrated by this. They say if we would talk about bodhicitta or lojong, you know, nobody turns up. If we talk about dzogchen, then everybody comes, you know. And so now usually they advertise dzogchen and talk about lojong. But yeah, I mean, the thing is to really be in command of our minds instead of being the slaves to our mind. To be the master of our minds. And then to directly experience that which is beyond the mind, the conceptual mind. And then that experience would be very profound, and you would be in the position to be able to enhance it. Normally, because our minds are so out of control, even if we get a glimpse, we don't know what to do with it. So, we're all going to practice, yes, yes, yes. You know, we are very, very fortunate to have Mingyur Rinpoche as a teacher for the Mahamudra path. He exemplifies his practice, and I think this is also very important to see. Like, if you do practice, what happens to you? We can all turn into miniature Mingyur Rinpoches, wouldn't that be nice? So we should be really very grateful, not only to Mingyur Rinpoche, but also to ourselves, because we, all of us, must have made tremendous amounts of good karma in the past to be in a position where we can listen to his teachings. Because, you know, you think how many billions of people there are in the world, and, you know, how many of those billions are listening to Mingyur Rinpoche's teachings on the nature of the mind? So you are very, very fortunate, all of you, and then you shouldn't waste this opportunity. You know, don't go away and just forget it and say, oh, that was a great time, I really enjoyed it, you know, and the food wasn't bad either. But really take what he has and put it in the center of your heart and practice it, and so that it can benefit yourself and other beings, not just in this lifetime, but in all your future lifetimes. Because if we waste these opportunities, then maybe they don't come again. Okay, so thank you very much.
Thank you. Now I have to go back to work.